This is the Australian Lure Fishing Podcast, where we're building Australia's largest and most comprehensive resource for Australian lure fishers. Join us every Monday, Wednesday and Friday as we break down the locations, the techniques and the tackle that you need to catch more fish on lures. Or visit our website, doclures.com, to get the free resources and tools that will help you to achieve the results that you want. So if improving your lure fishing is your aim, then settle in and enjoy the top information shared by our hosts and by top lure fishers from all around Australia.
Hi everybody and welcome to the Australian Lure Fishing Podcast. I am your guest host Andrew Deeth and on behalf of Greg Vinyl, I'm recording a short series on targeting and hopefully catching big brim. Now today's guest is someone who has invented and produced a lure which has become synonymous with big brim in Australia. Steve is the owner and creator of Cranker Lures, which of course includes the Cranker Crab. So now I would like to welcome back to the Australian Lure Fishing Podcast, Mr. Steve Steer. Welcome back and good evening, Steve.
Good evening, Andrew, and good evening, listeners, and it's a pleasure to be here again.
Yeah, I think this is your third trip to the Australian Lure Fishing Podcast.
Yeah, that's right. I've done one brim and one trout and back on the brim again.
Back to the brim. Back to the big brim.
That's it.
Okay, so for the listeners that may not be aware of whereabouts you're living at the moment, where are you from and how long have you been there?
I live in mid-northern Tasmania in a place called Deloraine. So it's basically midway between Launceston and Devonport. Been here for nearly 20 years now. Moved from Victoria just prior to having kids. So we thought it was a good place to come and raise a family and get away from the rat race a little bit. Plus, I'd fallen in love with the fishing in my many sort of travels to Tasmania over the years prior.
Yeah. So prior to Cranker Lures and that sort of thing, you were a keen tournament angler for many years prior to that, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I've been sort of brim fishing all my life, I guess. I grew up in Victoria in Bayswater, outer eastern sort of Melbourne, and used to go a lot to Mallacoota, Gippsland Lake, Bem River. Spent a lot of time sort of fishing those systems and grew up sort of cutting my teeth on trout in the sort of highlands of the Monaro region, Jindabyne and Eucanbeen and those areas. So, yeah, my family loves fishing, loved the outdoors, and I fell in love with it too, and, couldn't get enough of it. So that's where it all started.
So aside from brim, is trout one of your loves or what else do you like to chase on lures?
Yeah, look, I don't mind targeting anything with the swim, I guess. I love a bit of everything, but my two main species, passionate species, would be trout. I grew up sort of fishing for trout predominantly.
Yeah.
And probably at about the age 14, I started to really get into the brim. And, yeah, it pretty much started in the tournament scene when ABT sort of kicked off and fished many of the ABT events, both on the mainland and sort of in Tasmania.
Yeah, okay.
And also fished a lot of the sort of local classic team events over the years.
So with your trout fishing and brim fishing, was there much sort of crossover? Is there anything that you learnt from trout fishing that helped you with brim that might be sort of stand apart from somebody that hasn't fished for trout?
Yeah, for certain. I think trout teaches you a lot about where brim like to live, how they feed. It makes you observant, I guess. Trout fishing for me, growing up, was I had an uncle that was very good trout angler, really was ahead of his time in lure fishing and fly fishing, and he taught me a lot fishing like Jindabyne and Eucanbeen, the Thredbo River and all of that area, and I fell in love with specialist techniques that he used to do. He used to make his own little mud oval.
Yeah.
He'd make his own float, and he would stain them a particular colour and draw them across the surface, swimming a mud eye under a float at night on lakes like Jindabyne and Eucanbeen, and would absolutely slay the fish.
Yeah.
And he taught me that it was something a bit different that no one was really doing at the time.
Yeah.
And yeah, I fell in love with that sort of doing things a little bit differently, I guess. And it was good fun and taught me a lot. But in particular with trout, I think stream craft on small streams, sort of understanding where fish like position themselves in flow, I think really transfers across the brim in a big way. And I also found that brim eat a lot of the things that trout eat. It's just if you're not observant, you don't see them eating them. So such things as ants, flying ants, brim love them. It's just not often you get the situation or circumstances right where you visually watch brim eating ants on the surface, but they eat them just like trout do.
Yeah. Okay. That was. I think you covered off the questions I was going to ask about that, about where the brim, how trout taught you about where the brim would be, which I think relates to flow.
Yeah, flow. I think flow's the critical thing in any fishing, in my eyes. As ABT say, you know, no flow, no go, no run, no fun. Those stand true in most fishing situations that I've been in, had success in. If you can recognize the flow and position your lure, bait, whatever you're fishing in the right zone of the in the flow, then you're more likely to get eaten than not.
Yeah. So what if you're looking at the flow, are you looking, I guess, how the water flows around a point, around a pole, or have you got an example of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Heaps of examples. So wind flow is one thing, particularly with brim. Yeah, and trout, it's a very important thing that I guess a lot of newbies or a bit less experienced people tend to overlook. They don't think about the wind as creating flow, and the wind moves the surface water, creating flow past objects. Let's say, for instance, a bridge or a jetty, whereas the wind's funneling down a shoreline, hitting a jetty, and that wind flow is creating a little back eddy on the back of the pole.
Yep.
Where bait fish like to sit out of the flow, out of the wind.
Yep.
And where brim have come to recognize that bait fish like to hang.
Yeah.
There's also the benefit of the pole holding food, barnacles, crabs, mussels.
Yeah.
You name it. So sort of brim come to recognize a food area, a protected food area, and I guess flow and wind concentrates that food into those areas, and you're more likely to catch fish in those areas when the right conditions are forcing the bait or the fish into the flow zones or the little pockets in the flow.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess you're trying to either cast into either into the back eddy or cast it upstream a little bit so it actually flows down at the right water depth.
Yeah, absolutely. And fish are not silly, I guess, or particularly big brim. They don't get big by being silly.
Yep.
They're a slow growth species, so they take a long time to get to the size to be a trophy fish.
Yeah.
And those fish are very switched on. They've seen everything thrown at them.
Yeah.
They've had every scenario that fishing can throw at them, and they've survived, and they've got through it. They might have been caught here and there. They might have got off on occasion, but they've learned to avoid anglers' presentations, and you've got to be doing pretty much everything right, consistently anyway, catch better than average brim.
Yeah, okay. Very good. Very good. Yeah, it's near the second person spoken at length about wind. So I think that's really interesting. And also Greg just did a live stream where he talked at length about wind flow and what have you. So yeah, really interesting.
Yeah. Well, there's some classic examples, I guess, that I've witnessed over many, many years. And in particular at Gippsland Lakes. And Gippsland's renowned as a tough brim fishery. It can be extremely tough.
Yeah.
But it has a persistent sea breeze that kicks in at a certain time of the day, And typically that's about 11 a.m. It can be right through to 2 p.m., just depending on when the wind gets up.
Yeah.
But anglers that know Gippsland, you can be on the same spot at doing the same thing, and it's like a light switch. The fish go from eating nothing to eating everything you throw at them.
Yeah.
Just purely on the switch on of the wind.
Right. Right. And what's the predominant direction of wind there?
So typically wind sort of comes in from the east or southeast, or and it's not the greatest wind.
Yeah.
Normally in most systems, but really any wind at this land is a good thing.
Yeah, okay.
And no wind is tough, and it can be very tough when it's dead flat calm scenario at this land. And really any brim fishery is a lot tougher when it's dead flat calm. But a little bit of wind can make all the difference. And not, I guess, knowing that the wind can switch them on in an instant is an important thing to realise with brim fishing, because you can be doing everything right and you can be in the right area for big brim.
Yeah.
They just don't want to feed. They've got a feed window, a feed time.
Yep.
And timing and little tiny 1% of things make a big difference. So paying attention to what's going on,
yeah,
can turn a day around from nothing to the best day you've had on the water just by paying attention to the wind.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. Do you put much thought into like moon phases and bite periods and all that sort of stuff? Do you look into that, or do you just fish whenever you can?
I have over the years. I don't put a lot, when it comes to brim, I don't put a lot of emphasis on a lot of that. Tide, definitely. The wind, your approach, absolutely. Absolutely critical when it comes to bigger than average brim. Timing for me, which a lot of people tend to overlook, they don't pay close enough attention to the time, the feed times, that particularly flat feeding fish, they get into a rhythm, a timing rhythm, where they'll drop back to a zone that isn't their feeding zone.
Yeah.
And they'll sit just doggo, and you might come across those fish and there's fish everywhere and you think you've hit the jackpot.
Yep.
But they can be extremely tough to catch because they know you're there. They're not in a feeding mode. They're in a rest mode.
Yeah.
And you've got them at the wrong place, wrong time. So working out where fish prefer to feed and are in an active feeding mode can be the key to catching big fish consistently.
Right. And how do you propose that you would do that? What is that, just time on the water, or?
In my experience, you cannot beat time on the water.
Yep.
So typically to work out where big fish like to frequent and like to feed, I try to think of a system almost like a composted garden. So if you can imagine a garden grows big, good vegetables and good, strong, healthy trees with organic matter and compost and stirred into the soil over many, many years. You get the nutrients in the soil. It's the same for me with big brim. The older, the longer something's been in the system, been in the water, the more growth it has. And if you can imagine places like Gippsland, there's prime zones that always produce winning bags. And they're known about by most tournament anglers over years of trial and error. And what I've found is that a lot of that comes down to flood debris.
Yep.
So Gippsland and most systems get regular floods.
Yeah.
And if you look at the mouths of, say, the Mitchell River at Gippsland or the Tambo at Gippsland or the Nicholson, all of those systems feed into the lake. And when it floods, all those upstream snags, old growth, been in the water for hundreds of years potentially, can get washed off the shores and taken down in the flood, and they hit the lake where the river mouth hits the system and the flow dissipates.
Yeah.
And that flood debris drifts off to the side and sinks.
Yep.
And if you go to the mouth of the Tambo or the mouth of the Mitchell, you'll see snags.
Yep.
You'll see rubble beds. You'll see everything over hundreds of years that's collected from the flow slowing where it comes into the lake, and all that nutrient-rich flood debris comes out and dumps and sits on the bottom, and it starts breaking down. Now, that breakdown of organic matter brings with it life, and it brings with it shrimp, crab, crustaceans, you name it, bait fish, algae. It brings with it all sorts of life to that area.
Yeah.
And Big Broom get to know the areas that are prolific with growth and with life, and that's where they get their food from.
Yeah, okay.
So food to a brim is pretty much anything that's in the water. It can be from barnacles growing on the log or rock. It can be a mussel. It can be a bait fish. It can be shrimp. It can be pretty much anything that lives in, around, and on that structure is fair game to a big brim.
Yeah. Yeah, so old timber and what have you, and is certainly a good home for that sort of stuff.
So the older the better, in my eyes.
Yeah.
So where to find big brim consistently? I think if you study a system and you work out the oldest structure with the most growth with flow on it, on the edge of flow. So they don't like to sit in strong flow.
Yeah.
They like to sit comfortably on the edge of strong flow.
Yep.
A bridge pylon is a classic example of that. You have a narrow choke section in a system where they put bridges because it's the narrowest point across that waterway. So all the flow from that system is focused and generated through that narrow bottleneck.
Yep.
And the bridge is a structure that's been there typically for a long time.
Yep.
It's got a lot of growth on it. It's had a lot of flood debris come down and hit into its pylons and sink to the bottom.
Yeah.
You've got rubble and structure and shell and grit and everything growing on the bases of the poles that brim love to eat. So I guess my way of looking at a system to try and analyze, if I've never been there and I want to know where to catch better than average fish, I'm looking for the oldest growth that's been in that system for the longest period of time.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I don't want to put you on the spot in terms of exactly where to go, but I am going to. So in Tasmania, if you pick one of the main systems down there that you fish, I don't want you to give up your spots, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe you can give us something along those lines of what that would be, whether it is bridges or oyster racks, or I'm not sure.
No, absolutely. Look, there's probably three or four major systems in Tasmania that hold better than average fish.
Yeah.
Three of those, in my opinion, are on the north coast.
Yeah.
And they are Anson Bay on the northeast.
Yeah.
They are the Tamar River north of Launceston.
Yeah.
They are Port Sorrel, which is mid-north along the north coast. And it has 2 feeder rivers running into it.
Yeah.
It's sadly, you know, human intervention in a lot of systems, we dam.
Yeah.
And we cause disruption to the natural flow of rivers, which can destroy brim systems, in my opinion, just because they spawn by sort of moving up and down the system, and the flow, the old flow, pre-dam, is important to their spawning, the right salinity level. So big brim takes a long time to sort of grow in a system, and those man-made sort of disruptions cause problems for them.
Yeah.
So those systems, those three systems along the north, and then I would say the Derwent in the south, are probably the major big brim systems in Tasmania that I know and like to fish.
Yeah, okay. And within those systems, you're basically looking for old structure, whether it be bridges and, I guess, snags and what have you.
Yeah, well, any old structure. So it might be an individual log on a flat that's been there forever.
Yeah.
It's sat there. It's got a heap of growth on it. It's got a bit of an arch under it with a bit of shadow, which allows a fish to get under there and fish.
Yeah.
And that individual log on a otherwise barren shore
yeah.
can be an absolute mecca for big bream.
Yeah.
So, you know, as I said before, time on the water for me is critical to finding consistent big bream locations.
Yeah.
And but what I'll do is I'll break down a system by looking at it from that old growth perspective. So I'll jump on Google Earth, I'll have a look and go, right, there's a big wharf here that's been here forever. It's all timber poles. They've been in the system for 100 years.
Mm.
They're starting to break down. They've got a heap of life on them.
Yeah.
It's got good flow. It's on an outside corner where the wind pushes on it predominantly.
Yeah.
And I try and break the system down and pick some prime spots from observation, just yeah. general observation, and then I'll go and fish the bum out of them.
Yeah.
Just try and work out exactly where those big fish within that area like to frequent.
Yep.
And the more time you spend on them, and typically a good sunny day when you're prospecting
yep.
is a great thing. Some good polarized sunglasses so you can see what's going on, or a good sounder, and go and prospect those areas, spend time in those old growth, narrow bottlenecks, long time in the system, man-made structures,
yep.
and focus in those areas, fish them until you see, come across, bump into whatever it takes,
yep.
big fish, and make mental notes, physical notes, diary notes on where, how, why, what time of year. Because, as I said, timing
yeah.
for me is an absolute critical aspect of big bream fishing. And if you get your timing wrong, you can be in the right area
yeah.
and just get your timing slightly wrong, and I mean by minutes at times, you can hit those fish when they're not quite in a feeding mood
yeah.
and you can upset them.
Yeah.
If they know you're there, they know you're in the area and you're fishing, and you have hit them at the wrong time, they can be near impossible to tempt
yeah.
with any lure. Doesn't matter what you've got tied on.
Yeah.
But give yourself every chance to catch those fish by the approach, the timing, and spending time on the water getting to know those fish.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I think what you've said translates to most of the systems that we all fish. Like, it's all the same. It's not just going to be Tasmania or Gippsland. Like, yeah, finding the flow yep. and the pinch points and what have you. So that's really good. All right. Now that we've narrowed down where to find, as best we can, big bream, let's work through. I think we'll start with lures, and we'll do the same thing as the normal ALF podcast. We'll go, what are your three big fish lures that you would have tied on if you're targeting that extra large bream?
Yeah. The first one's really, and it's proven to me over the last maybe 6 years,
yep.
I've been throwing it, and that is a 65-mil crab. 65-mil crabs caught me more big bream than any other lure that I own.
Yeah.
I have a lot of lures.
yeah. So explain to us the difference between the 50-mil and the 60-mil in terms of hooks and all that sort of stuff. And
yeah, 50 mil has small size 14 decoy YF25 treble
yep.
in the claws.
Yeah.
The 65 has size 12 and it has a 25 pound ring, foot ring rating. So you've got a size 12 decoy YF25, which is a very strong,
yeah,
stout hook, and you've got solid split rings.
Yeah.
And a screw wire design.
Yeah.
So the wire that connects to the claws goes straight through the crab to your toe point.
Yeah.
So you've got basically true wire connection for the fish. And that size crab just is a good meal,
yeah,
and it tempts the better than average fish. You might not catch the numbers,
yeah,
that you would catch with a 50 mil crab.
Yeah.
But for us, we basically have stopped throwing 50 mil crabs down here in Tas.
Yep.
And we really only throw 65 mil crabs.
Yeah.
When we're throwing crabs.
Yeah, okay. So that it definitely, it's a big fish lure in terms of, yeah. Do you think the big fish come in and muscle the little ones out? Do you think that's a real thing?
That can be a real thing if you're in an area. But a lot of my big brim fishing is typically to individual fish,
yep,
or small packs of big fish.
Yep.
I don't normally find big brim mixed in, like extra big brim, mixed in with lots of smaller fish.
Yeah, okay.
Not really a weeding game down here in Tas.
Yeah.
It's more an individual area, an area where a big brim likes to feed.
Yeah.
And they tend to get prime position.
Yeah.
Like a big trout does in a stream.
Yeah.
They'll get the prime old growth area in the shade, tucked way back where they can sit comfortably. They've kicked every little fish out of the area.
Yeah.
And they've got the whole place to themselves.
Yeah. Okay. There you go. Yeah. So the large crab for big brim.
Yeah. So Tassie's blessed with big brim, I guess.
Mm.
I guess defining what I call a big brim.
Yeah.
Is sort of when I'm talking individual fish and targeting specific areas where they feed.
Yeah.
I guess what I would class as a big brim for Tas standards would be anything over 42 to the fork.
Okay.
But in some systems, 44 plus
yeah.
to the fork is what I would class as a good fish, a trophy sort of fish.
Yeah. Okay. So one thing that I did mention, did mean to go through earlier, which I'm going to circle back to, is why don't you tell us a story about a brim that stands out in your memory, whether it's a big brim or one that was a lucky capture or whatever the story is. Yeah, just take us back to the type of day it was, what weather it was, and try and take us there. Could you do that?
Look, one that really sticks in my memory is a fish that I caught in the St. Helens ABT event when I won it one year.
Yeah.
I've won that event twice. Of those events, I've had big brim.
Yeah.
But the one that sticks out, I was fishing with my non-boater out the front
yep.
of St. Helens, which is, at that stage, it hadn't been fished a lot. There wasn't many anglers fishing that area. Most anglers fished the main flat and the rack
yep.
closer to town. And out the front of St. Helens, the water's crystal clear, particularly on a push-in tide. And the big fish are there. They're not easy. They're yep. never easy.
Yeah.
And so I found a flat that had fish digs on it, and they were digging. They were getting up on the high tide and they were feeding. And I could see puffs of smoke or sand being sort of coming off the flat. Just, it was super shallow up on top and we couldn't really get to those dig positions. So my non-boater and I were going along the edge of a deeper gutter along the edge of the flat. And there were eagle rays working the flat as well.
Okay.
And I watched this eagle ray come across the flat and I could see shadows just on its tail, just right on its tail. And I pitched, at the time I was throwing a jackal tiny fry. You can't cast them very far. I landed it right on the tail end of the eagle ray.
Yeah.
And just drew my lure down to behind its tail and got eaten instantly. And the water just erupted and the eagle ray took off at a million miles an hour.
Yep.
And three or four brim that were following that eagle ray, picking up its scraps, were underneath its shadow. And right. as soon as that eagle ray took off, we could see them and we seen them scatter and yep. I was hooked up to the better fish of the lot.
Yeah.
And that fish went crazy. They pulled hard at St. Helens. It came out and tried to bury me in deep weed multiple times.
Yeah.
I had to get right over the top of it and palm the spool and turn its head. And it was real heart in the mouth sort of fishing. And I eventually landed that fish and it was a 184 that set the, I think it still the Taz tournament biggest brim record.
Right.
In ACT history at this stage.
Yep.
There's been bigger bags. That fish, a 184, was a record fish for Tasmania.
Yeah, it's a cracking fish.
In a tournament. So, yeah, it sticks in my memory, that one, and it, of course, won me the tournament. And, yeah, it was on day two, and it was a great catch, and we were cheering and jumping around the boat like madmen.
Yeah, as you would be. As you would be. Tell me, the lure was a tiny fry, is that what you said?
Yeah, jackal tiny fry.
I don't know what that is.
Tiny little, I think they're 30 mil maybe.
Yeah.
Not even that. They're tiny little things, but good little shallow water lure, very shallow water. And we were fishing really skinny, clear. And at St. Helens, there's little prawns and krill almost.
Yeah.
That have an orange, like a burnt orange salmon roe colour inside them. So they're clear, but they have a burnt orange, almost internal to them. And so this little jackal tiny fry represented that as a little salmon roe coloured jackal tiny fry, clear but with a salmon roe spot.
Yeah, I'll look that up. Like I said, I'm not familiar with it.
And our cranker cranked a what we call ghost shrimp colour.
Yeah.
Came from that colour. I used to get a lot of lures pimped.
Yep.
With Dan Said and various others that used to do pimping. I used to get a lot of my lures pimped in that colour for St. Helens. It was a standout colour for me.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's that in some systems, one colour will stand out. So, yeah. All right. That's a really good story, especially for such a big brim. All right. We're going to double back in. We're going to just do a U-turn again and go back to lures. So what would be your second lure you would have tied on?
Second lure would be a 50 to 80 mil suspending jerkbait. Suspension's critical for black brim. Being able to hang the lure in the zone and potentially tease big brim into eating it is very important with big brim. And there's been many times where I've had a big brim following a lure.
Yeah.
And you have to really work that lure to get them fired up.
Yeah.
Each time they get up on it, you tweak it away.
Yeah.
As they get closer to it, you pull it away again. Too much movement can suit them. Not enough movement, they lose interest.
Yeah.
It's a real fine art, and a suspending jerkbait is a great way to tease big brim into eating a lure.
Yeah, so it sounds like a real game of cat and mouse. Like if you pull it too fast, it's unnatural and spooks them. If you don't move it enough, it's unnatural as well.
Yep. And the suspension's critical. It's got to hang like a real bait fish. Bait fish don't sink when you stop and when they stop swimming, and they don't float.
Yeah.
They just hang horizontal in the water column.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't look natural to a big brim, they typically won't eat it. So getting something as natural, a lot of real natural bait fish colours, suspending and hanging in the zone for as long as possible, it can be heart-in-the-mouth, frustrating sort of fishing to get those big fish to eat. And if you just happen to do the wrong thing, you know, you upset them.
Yep.
And that only learned through trial and error on the water.
Yeah. Yeah, so watching the big fella, and then you twitch it the wrong way and off it flies.
Yeah, and some of the best advice I could give anyone who wants to target big brim and become better at it would be to go to a clear water system lower in the system towards the entrance of, say, Mallacoota or Fem River or any of those, and just spend time on sighted fish. Try your approach, just slow, supple, stealthy. Get yourself in a zone where you're seeing fish and then spend time throwing lures at them and watching how they react.
Yeah, okay.
I spent years doing that, either waiting or boat-based, sort of sneaking up on fish on the electric and sight casting to them. And I think you can learn some real valuable lessons in how to retrieve a lure or when not to retrieve a lure. From that situation, from that sight casting situation.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting. I like the fact that you mentioned wading because it makes it open to all anglers, like anyone can go and walk the flats. Yeah.
The majority of my teeth cutting on brim, sight casting brim with lures was wading, walking systems, walking the edges, really stealthily, you know, watching my shadow, watching which way sort of the sun was creating my shadow on the water, and just that approach to the water. Approach for big brim particularly can be critical. As I say, they're highly alert and aware and they're familiar with their surroundings. So anything that's not natural tends to put them off their game. And they see you there, you move too fast, soon enough they'll know you're there and they really will shut shop. They almost get locked jaw. They may sit there looking at you, but when it comes to eating anything you throw at them, you really need to be on your game with your approach.
Yeah. To ask what could be a dumb question, are you casting into the sun or away from the sun, or does it depend?
Sometimes the situation just dictates that you have to cast in or away or whatever it might be, particularly land-based when you're wading. You don't really have much choice when you come across sight-casted sighting brim and they're in the shallows and you're learning how to approach them and how to, I think you don't have too many choices. You've just got to make the best of the situation. So looking at where the sun is and looking at where the wind's coming from and trying to land your lure not behind the fish, slightly off at a 45, maybe 30 degree angle in front of the fish is important. If you land a lure too hard behind a brim, particularly a big brim, they'll startle more than it makes them jump. You know, it's almost like someone's sneaking up on you and tapping you on the shoulder. You know, you don't see it coming. And it scares you more than excites you, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So approach and thinking about the way the fish is working, watching it for a minute, trying to watch it from a distance so that you're not spooking it doesn't know you're there, sort of trying to work out its feet, what it's doing, which direction it's going in, the way the wind's blowing, the way the sun's shining, and getting yourself in a position so that you can cast ahead of the fish that's slightly off its eye line and landing as gentle as possible on the water surface with your lures. So in that situation, I'm not throwing a 65-mil crab that lands like a pelican. I'm throwing a light, lightly weighted plastic, or I'm throwing a light hard body that I can land gently, and I'm feathering my cast. I'm doing a low-to-water cast. So I'm doing an almost Arenberg underarm cast that goes low to the water, and then I just stop it with my finger on the spool and land it gently right near the fish.
Yeah. So if you catch the line on the spool, then it just helps that lure sometimes to just float down really gently, particularly if it's with the breeze. Does that sound fair?
Yeah. I used to tournament cast. That was one of my passions. So I spent a lot of time tournament casting at the various fishing and boat shows around Australia and had a ball doing it. And I learned a lot and it's helped me immensely with my fishing because, you know, being able to put a lure where you need to put it can at times be the most important thing you can do to get that fish to eat.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes if you're talking structure, if you're even, you know, 20 centimetres off the mark, it's not close enough.
Yep.
You've just got to hit where that structure hits the water.
Yeah, and normally that first cast is the most important cast. So, you know, thinking about your cast before you make it, and that can be hard too because as soon as you start thinking about where you want to put a lure and how you want to put it there, it takes practice to not choke that cast and make a balls up of it and put it not where you want it.
Yeah, I think I heard you say that in your previous interview to say that a lot of people rush up to a spot and just try and fire a cast out, whereas taking your time can give you a better result overall.
Absolutely. But for big brim in particular, do you know, you know, you've done your homework, spent time on the water, you've analysed the system, you've found some big brim, you know where they live and where they feed, and you are specifically targeting them, you really need to do everything you can to approach that area at the right time, in the right manner, as stealthily as possible. Put everything in your favour, make the cast as best you possibly can, and be ready to tackle that fish. Have all the one percenters, have good knots, have good tackle, have a good mindset that you're going to go in, you're going to catch that fish, and you're going to get it out away from wherever it likes to live.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm going to circle back to mindset in a minute, but can we, let's move on to the third lure. What else would you like to have tied on?
I guess it's not so much a lure that I use to specifically target big brim, but I use it as a search tool if I'm covering water, and that would be a suspending crank. So a small 35 to 40 mil crank that casts well, covers water, and I can gauge the mood of fish in an area through that. Cranks have quite a strong action, and you can work them fairly fast. You can cover water quickly, so you can establish feeding zones. You can find areas where fish are typically feeding. In a pre-fish, say, for instance, I might be throwing a crank a lot, whereas when I'm going to target those fish that I've found on that pre-fish day the next day in a comp, I'll be switching it up to a crab or to a minnow, a jerkbait, to target those fish. But that would be my third lure. That would be a lure that I use a lot as a search tool, would be a crank.
A crank. So you're talking like you've got your own one, like the cranker crank or a jackal chubby or an atomic, yep. 38, that sort of thing is what you're talking about?
Yep, any of those. There's some really good cranks on the market, but in particular, I guess the black brim, which is my specialty, there's not many that suspend, and ours is one of the only ones that suspends in brackish water.
Yeah.
That, for me, the black brim is absolutely critical. So that's why we built it that way. It's a small, good casting, suspending, light rattle, not too loud lure, and it's a great search tool for finding feeding fish.
Sure. And do you tweak your own lures at all? Do you, like, if you find that it's not suspending on a day, or maybe it is, would you change the hooks up?
No, look, back in the day, I was a sponsored angler by several well-respected sort of Australian brands and international brands, and I've got a lure box bigger than most people, and I've spent, I don't know how much money on lures over the years, but a lot. And I've been through every brand that I can find that I think is a great lure, and I've spent a lot of time tweaking, amending, making them do what I want them to do.
Yeah.
And really, that's where Cranker came from. I got to a point where I just realized that I was tweaking a lot of the stuff in my boxes to achieve the results that I was trying to achieve. And I was talking to my sponsors about making lures do the things that I wanted them to do.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, a lot of brands are international based.
Yeah.
So they're sort of based on species outside of Australia, and particularly not brim. Most of them are bass or, you know, trout or some sort of international species of fish. They're not specifically targeted. These days it's a little bit more different. People are getting a bit more species specific in the way in their lure design.
Yeah.
But that's where Cranker came from, in that I just got to a point where I thought, well, I'm not getting the results that I need from out of the packet off the shelf lures.
Yeah.
I want a lure that does it the way I need it to do it. And so Cranker was created, and
yeah,
the lures that we create are specifically designed for targeting brim, and in particular black brim.
Yeah. Well, that's all really cool. Yeah, moving on to just, it was like within the brim circles, there's always this discussion between whether you use braid and leader or straight through and that sort of thing. Whereabouts do you sit with that? Are you more predominantly a straight through fluorocarbon, or do you prefer braid and leader, or do you do both?
For many years, I was a proponent of braid and leader, but very long leaders. I used to run 7 meter leaders,
yep,
of light fluorocarbon attached to fire line, braid sort of. I've gone away from that since developing the crab.
Yeah.
Basically, I will use braid and leader for, say, deep trout situations where I'm fishing deep water. I need feel. I want feedback to the hand for a very light pickup or touch on lure. So that's where braid and leader comes into its own.
Yeah.
Deep water situations. I rarely ever fish braid and leader these days. And I found when I developed the crab, it took a long time to work out a rod, a reel, a line system to stop me from either pulling hook on big fish, extra big fish, or getting smoked and dusted by big fish. And it was a really fine line. And it took me a long time. We were hooking monster fish in tournaments and just getting blown away by them or pulling hooks on them if we went too hard. And it took us a long time to establish a good system. And I ended up with fluorocarbon straight through, 5 pounds in general for most tight structure situations, racks, bridges, you know, jetties, boat hulls, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I'm fishing 5 pounds straight through fluorocarbon. And then if I'm in a bit more open water, I've got 3 pounds straight through fluorocarbon.
Okay. And what is there a brand that you have a preference for?
There is. And it's an old one. It's been around for quite a while. I just used it, got a liking to it, and I've seen no reason to change. And that is Famil Yamatoyo spinning fluoro.
Okay. Yep.
I think it's just got a nice amount of stretch, a little bit of suppleness, but it's not too supple that it lays nicely on most small spin reels.
Yeah. I'm still divided in my own thoughts about all of that. Yeah. I've struggled sometimes with putting the straight through, particularly in the lighter sizes, it has too much memory sometimes. So, yeah, just interesting.
Yeah, look, I found that too, and that's really, I've settled on Yamatoyo spinning fluoro. It's designed for spinning reels. It's a high-quality Japanese. It's not overly cheap, but it's a good fluorocarbon for me. It doesn't let me down. It ties good knots. It has reasonable abrasion resistance, but suppleness is the correct, I guess it's stiffness versus suppleness is just the right thing for small spin reels, in my opinion.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I'll have to re-go through that. Everyone's got their own opinion on this stuff, and I guess you've got to work out what works for you.
You do. And once you find something that works, just stick with it. There's no need to change. And that's what I've found with that. It's been great for me.
And rods and reels?
Rods and reels. So I run a Miller Switchfreak LT for my open water brimming. So that really most situations, all flat situations, and I'm running that for crabs and 65 mil crabs as well, and jerkbait and crank. It's a do-it-all rod. It really is a sweet little stick. So that's probably my main go-to rod. And then if I'm fishing tight structure, I've got two rods. One's a Miller rod prototype that Ian worked on for quite some time. That's a rod that we've been playing with. So I use that. And I've got that the main one I use that's on the market and available is called a Bass Freak M. It was designed for bass in the rivers in tight structure. And I use it specifically for a 6 foot. It's a short rod. I like a short rod for tight structure. It's a control for low cast where I'm casting under structure, under jetties, under boat holes, under undercut banks and bridge pylons and what have you. So that little short bass freak is an ideal rod for that tight structure, and it's got the power to pull fish away from structure when you need to.
Turn their heads and what have you. And mostly you'd be, if you're doing structure, I assume you'd be throwing the 5 pound.
Yeah, I have. I'm normally loaded. I've got a Daiwa 2004 or 2500 size reel. Certates, Caesars exist, are what I typically run, and love them. They are great, beautiful little reels. They lay line perfectly. I guess, you know, you don't have to spend that sort of money these days. There are some great little reels on the market. But for me, as I said, yeah, those one percenters really matter when you need them to. So paying attention to every little detail. And if you've got one little bit of loose line laid on the spool prior to your cast on a big fish and you hook up and he gets his head, normally you're done. Or you've got an underbind or whatever. So just paying attention to that sort of stuff. If you know you're on a good fish and you know you need to make that cast, strip out a little bit of line, wind it back under tension through your fingers. Make sure that it's really neatly packed on your reel. You've got that perfect cast and nothing's going to fail.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of the, like you said, one of the one percenters, which will help people to either catch and, you know, first hook and then land a fish where they may not have if they haven't paid attention.
Yep.
Right. That covers all the technical stuff. I'm going to throw one more question at you, lure-based, given you've been on the scene for a long time. If you think way back in the day, is there any lure that you think's largely been forgotten by kind of the modern brim angler? Is it something you go back to and go, oh, that's a big brim lure from way back in the day?
There is one. And I was sponsored by Berkeley Pure Fishing at one stage, and they used to make a 3-inch lugworm. They called it a lugworm. They only, I think, ever made it in a glow colour. So it was pearl white glow, but it's sort of like a fry to some degree in that, for me, at times on big fish, less is more. So less action in the tail, in the movement of the lure, can get the bite when wiggly lures that move a lot.
Yeah.
Can turn off big fish at times. So that subtleness of action, silence, because sometimes silent worms, bait fish, they don't swim around with rattles in them. So sometimes silence can be great. That's another benefit of our crab in that, you know, you haven't got sound. So, yeah, that lugworm, for me, I used to dye it to colours that I found worked. And there was a Malacuta event that I won on that lure, or Wayne Freeby and I won many years ago with a great bag of fish. And we had 16 boats around us at one stage and no one was catching fish but us. And we were bagged out by 7:30 and we were upgrading constantly all day. And for many years, we didn't let on what that lure was, but I woke Wayne Freeby up in the night after pre-fish with me shaking my packets of lugworms, dyeing them to the colour that I needed.
Yeah, that's a really cool answer. Yeah, sometimes I think having a point of difference with the brim is critical. Like you have to throw something different at them.
Yeah, and they've got that, they glow, they've got a glow factor to them. So they glow in the dark. And I think when you dye them, you get a combination of subtle glow in brackish water in a blood worm colour can be absolutely dynamite on its day. And what twigged me to that was the pre-fish. We went up on an edge where the weed is quite thick along the edge. It's real thin ribbon weed. And I know from years of experience that when fish get on lugworms, they dig them out of the bottom. And they get in on the edge of the weed. So they're an intertidal worm and they live on the edge of the weed line. And the brim get in on that weed and they dig into the bottom and they pull the strips of weed out trying to get to the lugworm. So I sat there on pre-fish and we were going along a shore and I noticed thin strips of weed coming up to the surface and floating and laying out on the surface.
Okay.
And I knew straight away from that action that they were on lugworms. And at that time, we caught bugger all in pre-fish. I put on a lugworm and first cast I caught a fish and I put it away and I didn't say to Wayne anything about it.
Okay.
He asked me that night, where do you think we should fish? And I said, I know exactly where we need to go and I know exactly what we need to throw. And he said, how can you say that we had a crap crayfish? And I said, look, I've just seen the signs of something that I've seen before.
Yep.
That it took me to what's going to do it for us. And sure enough, it worked straight away. And we bagged out, you know, in the first half an hour of the comp each morning, where it was a very tough fight outside of cracking that cone.
Yeah, that's a fantastic answer. That's the type of thing that can separate yourself in a competition as well as just catching big brim in general.
Yeah, absolutely. Just, I guess, observation, as I say, it's a critical factor when it comes to big brim, in my opinion. And just time on the water, spending time out there learning about those little things that trig you to, you've seen them, you've been on the water, you know the situation, and keeping a diary. You know, I kept a diary from since I was about 12 years old. And I started with a handwritten paper diary, and I ended up with an electronic diary with everything from moon phases, barometric pressure, temperature, water temp, lures used, fish caught, water depth most successful retrieve. And then I put in images from the day. I just use an Excel spreadsheet. I put images of the catch images of the day and I write in all that information and then I can recall on it at any time. And I've done it for years and years and years. And if I'm going to a new system that I don't know and I, at a certain time of year, I'll look up that time of year and I'll look at what I was doing at that time of year that was successful.
Yeah.
And it helps you go into the arena with a bit of an understanding of what to expect, I guess.
Yeah. So for someone that maybe hasn't kept a diary before, how long do you think it would take to make a difference to your fishing if you start keeping a diary?
Look, it happens within 6 months. It depends on how much you fish, I guess. I've done a lot of fishing in my time and I pay particular attention to the little things. And I think I make note of those little things. And sometimes it's that tiny little thing, like noticing the weed floating up and knowing that they're on lugworms, which is not a common sort of food source for them. And they're not found everywhere. They're only found in specific zones in the intertidal zone. And just sort of understanding that took research and took a lot of on-water sort of understanding, seeing fish doing peculiar things in weed that made me question, what are they doing? They're head down, they're in the weed, they're digging that weed out. They're getting into there for some reason. What lives in there? So then researching and just, it took a lot of work. And it does take time, but trust me, in 6 months, if you're fishing once a week, within no time, you're going to have pretty good record. And honestly, sometimes you learn the most from the hardest day on the water. Writing down what didn't work is probably far more important than writing down what did work.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, I tried this, it didn't work. I didn't catch a damn thing on it. And not being stuck in your ways and just sticking with a certain thing because it worked for you on a certain day at a certain time, that's in your diary. Write that down, but don't get fixated on it that it's always going to catch a fish. You need to play, experiment and find out for yourself on the water through trial and error. And I'm that type of angler that when I'm out with mates and we're all on the fish and we're donging them,
mm-hmm.
I'm not one to keep that lure that's catching the crap out of them on my rod. I'm switching through everything trying to find what doesn't catch them. And when I find something that doesn't catch them on a good bite, I then know, righto, I make a note. On this day, in this situation, this lure does not work.
Yeah. Yeah, and that could be one of your favourite lures.
And it could be on a different day, a different system. So those little 1%ers, to me, build up over time, and they build up pretty quickly with a diary, particularly with sounders these days. Some of the electronics on boats and stuff at the moment getting around really can fast track your learning so quickly. compared to doing it the old school way that I did. So, yeah, get out there, get the tech, spend the time on the water, keep a diary, and it'll pay for itself in no time.
Yeah, well, I think about 12 months ago on this podcast, Greg was promoting an app called Fishing Points. So with this app, you can take a photo and then load that photo into the app. And from that, it takes all the data off it. And it'll tell you, based on your location, what the tide was doing, what the wind was that day, tells you all the information about what the weather was that day. So it's, I think, invaluable for about $30 a year.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Critical information, and it can help you on any system, particularly if you don't know a system and you're going fresh into a new area, you know, looking at your diary and just going, right, at this time of year, the fish should be in this zone because I've caught them in that zone at this time of year in other systems. It really hones down, you know, gives you a lot to work with.
Mm. Well, there you go. Well, mate, this has been an awesome chat. I think we're going to start to bring this to a close. So how can any anglers out there get in touch with you? Can they find you on Facebook or Instagram, or where can they reach out to you if they had a question?
Yep. So I'm Steve Steer on Facebook, or you can jump on our Crank and Lures Facebook page. So, yeah, I answer questions for people coming down to Taz or tripping down here wanting to know a little bit. I'm always talking to people, giving them some information on where they can go and catch a fish. So don't hesitate. I'm more than happy to help genuine fishers get onto fish. So, yeah, Crank and Lures on Facebook or Instagram, or Steve Steer on Facebook.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, like if you have a look on Crank and Lures, you can see all the lures. You've got minnows and vibes and crabs. And have you got anything else coming out in the future? You got some stuff we're working on?
Yeah, we've got a heap of new stuff. It's been in development for a very long time, and we cannot wait to show people. They're getting close. Yeah, it's exciting. We have a new crab as well. You'll see that coming soon. Yeah, everything we've learned from the crab, we've improved upon, and we've made it stronger, more resilient, better finished, and we can't wait to show everybody, more versatile.
Awesome. Awesome. I look forward to that. All right. Well, mate, this has been an awesome interview, and I could have kept going, but I think we're probably at about the right time. So, mate, you've shared so much, and I truly think that a big brim series probably wouldn't have been quite complete without the inventor creator of Cranker Crabs. So finally, to wrap this up, do you have any one last tip or final inspiration for anglers just targeting those big brim? What would you like to leave them with?
I guess the most important thing for me, slow down, be observant. When you get a bite or catch a fish, stop. Think about what you were doing. Think about where you were fishing, how you were retrieving, when it ate it, what depth it was. That little moment that you take out to actually look at what you just did can really improve your day or your week or your year moving forward.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's pretty sound advice. All right, well, there you go, everybody. Thanks so much for listening, and I'm sure you all got something out of that. And on behalf of Steve, myself and Greg, tight lines, and we'll see you on the water.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Australian Lure Fishing Podcast. I hope you got some great value from today's episode. Don't forget to subscribe on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. In fact, wherever you listen to podcasts, make sure you subscribe to ALF. And for show notes, downloads, maps, and other free resources, make sure you go to doclures.com and check out what we've got for ALF listeners there. Until the next episode, stay safe, tight lines, and may the fish be with you.